Pub History, the show that brings you fascinating stories from Boston history. This is episode 35, our Independence Day special. Hi, I'm Nikki.
And I'm Jake. This week, we're going to talk about what it meant to be a hyphenated American in the hyper-partisan atmosphere of the World War I era. 100 years ago, as American doughboys were shipping off to serve on the lines in France, people on the home front were all too willing to imprison or even deport their neighbors of German descent. Here in Boston, the preeminent director of the Boston Symphony Orchestra was affected, along with almost a third of the orchestra's musicians. But before we talk about how the Boston Symphony weathered World War I, it's time to take a look at what's coming up this week in Boston history.
Monday is July 3rd, and on July 3rd, 1728, two young men stayed up late, drinking and playing cards at the Royal Exchange Tavern, which stood on King Street, which we now know as State Street. The establishment was known as a noted resort of the solid men of Boston, as well as the gay blades of the town who were in the habit of drinking and gaming there. Benjamin Woodbridge was just 20 years old, a student at Harvard, and a descendant of Harvard's first graduate. He had grown up in Barbados, but his father sent him to Boston to finish his education. Even then, Harvard had a soft spot for legacies. His drinking buddy was Henry Phillips, the 23-year-old brother-in-law of Peter Faneuil, who would go on to build a fine public market for the town. The reasons for it are lost, but at some point, the two quarreled. They were friends, but they were young, hot-blooded, drunk friends. And their quarrel would end in what is usually referred to as the first duel in Boston. The two men left the tavern, agreeing to retrieve their weapons and meet on Boston Common. A newspaper reported what was found the next day. About 3 in the morning, after some hours' search, was found dead near the Powder House in the Common, the body of Benjamin Woodbridge, a young gentleman merchant of this place. He had a small stab under the right arm, but what proved fatal to him was a thrust he received under his right breast, which came out at the small of his back. Royal Governor Dummer put up wanted posters all over town searching for Henry Phillips, but he was gone. He had used his merchant family's connections to secure immediate passage on a ship bound for Europe. He would never set foot in Massachusetts again. Benjamin Woodbridge is buried in the Granary Burying Ground. We'll have a lot more on dueling in Massachusetts in a future episode.
The very first ship that was built in Massachusetts was launched on July 4th, 1631. The Blessing of the Bay was built by a pair of shipwrights along the Mystic River in what's now Medford. She was built to order for the governor of the colony, John Winthrop. The Blessing was described as a pinnace or bark, high-bowed with one mast, built mostly of locust, a very hard, strong wood. On her inaugural voyage, the Blessing navigated around the treacherous waters of Cape Cod and Long Island to reach the tiny settlement of New Amsterdam, which we now, of course, call New York City. There, the crew would trade New England-made sea salt, maple sugar, and clapboards for molasses, spices, and tea that the Dutch settlers were importing. William Clark says that the Blessing was primarily a trading vessel, but armed and designed to fight. How appropriate, then, that the first ship built in Massachusetts was chosen to pursue the first pirate to come from Massachusetts. If you remember the story of Dixie Bull from last week's podcast, you know that he began plying Massachusetts waters in late 1632. When the governor dispatched an armed vessel with a crew of 20 to chase Dixie Bull, it was the Blessing of the Bay that he chose. Bull had disappeared by then, and the Blessing returned to her normal role as a trading vessel. Despite its stout construction and historical significance, the Blessing of the Bay disappears from the record quickly. Henry Hall speculates that the Blessing of the Bay ran to Long Island and other settled localities for a short time and then disappeared from view. And it is possible that she was the unfortunate vessel that was sent by Winthrop and others from Boston to Virginia in 1633 with a load of fish and furs, and was wrecked on the Capes when near her destination.
Wednesday is July 5th, which marks the anniversary of early America's greatest infrastructure project. The Middlesex Canal would bypass the Merrimack River and connect the interior of New Hampshire with the port of Boston, opening exciting new markets for both. On July 5th, 1802, 8 years after construction began, the canal was flooded from Billerica to Woburn. The newspapers at the time captured the excitement of the day and heaped praise on the construction superintendent, Lomy Baldwin. On Monday last, water was admitted to the Middlesex Canal as far as Woburn Meeting House. More than 120 ladies and gentlemen embarked upon its waters. Although the party was numerous, the construction of the boat was such that the accommodations were convenient. This new mode of passing through a country diversified by almost every variety of landscape produces effects the most pleasing and agreeable. The proprietors deserve the highest praise for their enterprise. The choice of a superintendent demands commendation. Unwilling to acknowledge dependence upon any nation or any state, they reposed confidence in a citizen of their own. His works declare his praise. Even Massachusetts, a state already proud in science, will in some future age feel an increase of pride to acknowledge her son. There was even a terrible poem praising Baldwin in the canal, which closes, "With rising locks, a thousand hills alarms, flings over a thousand streams its silver arms, feeds the long vale, the nodding woodland laves, and plenty, arts and commerce freight the waves."
In another callback to last week's show, notorious pirate Captain William Kidd was arrested in Boston on July 6, 1699. At the time, he still claimed to be acting as a privateer, a legitimate businessman who was authorized by the crown to attack ships belonging to pirates and enemy nations. The governor, Lord Bellamont, was a friend and partner, so Kidd believed that he was perfectly safe. Just a few days earlier, he had gotten a letter from the governor that said, in part, "You may safely come hither. I make no manner of doubt but to obtain the king's pardon for you. I assure you on my word and on my honor, I will perform nicely what I have now promised." In fact, Kidd even stayed at the Province House with the governor while they were both visiting Boston. However, Captain Kidd's reputation as a pirate, whether it was deserved or not, was spreading on both sides of the Atlantic. Governor Bellamont and the other prominent men who had invested in Kidd's privateering voyage were being implicated in supporting piracy. Suddenly, his association with Kidd went from being potentially profitable to downright disastrous. The solution was simple. Instead of presenting the captain as a friend, the governor would turn him over to the crown as a prisoner. After days of jovial conversation and lighthearted interrogation, the mood turned. As Kidd was walking near the Province House in what is now Downtown Crossing, an officer grabbed his shoulders from behind, saying, "You are my prisoner." He would be locked in the Stone Jail in Boston for almost a year, in deplorable conditions, kept chained in irons the whole time, before being shipped back to London to stand trial. In the end, he was hanged, and his body was gibbeted over the Thames as a warning to others who might consider a life of piracy.
Friday is July 7th. Having taken command of the Continental Army on July 3rd, 1775, George Washington waded directly into the flood of accusations, counterclaims, and court-martial that had resulted from the Battle of Bunker Hill. One of the first things he did was to pass judgment on a captain of artillery who General Israel Putnam insisted should be court-martialed for cowardice. The Massachusetts Provincial Congress recorded that, "General Israel Putnam informed us that in the late action, as he was riding up Bunker's Hill, he met an officer of the train drawing his cannon down in great haste. He ordered the officer to stop and go back. He replied he had no cartridges. The general dismounted and examined his boxes and found a considerable number of cartridges, upon which he ordered him back. He refused, until the governor threatened him with immediate death, upon which he returned up the hill again, but soon deserted his post and left the cannon." Washington's orders from July 7th outline his final verdict. "It is with inexpressible concern that the general, upon his first arrival in the army, should find an officer sentenced by a general court-martial to be cashiered for cowardice, a crime of all others, the most infamous in a soldier, the most injurious to an army, and the last to be forgiven. Inasmuch as it may, and often does happen, that the cowardice of a single officer may prove the destruction of the whole army. The general, therefore, though with great concern, and more especially as the transaction happened before he had command of the troops, thinks himself obliged for the good of the service to approve the judgment of the court-martial with respect to Captain John Callender, who is hereby sentenced to be cashiered. Captain John Callender is accordingly cashiered and dismissed from all further service in the Continental Army as an officer. Despite the seeming finality of that verdict, Callender eventually found himself back in the Continental Service. He went to New York in the fall of 1776 and enlisted as an artillery cadet. During the Battle of Brooklyn, the officers in his unit were killed, and he took over command of the company until they were collectively taken prisoner by the British. After a prisoner exchange, he was commissioned as a captain lieutenant in 1777 and served out the war.
John Adams made a note in his journal on July 8, 1786, comparing the manure in London to that on his farm back home, and he found London's wanting. At the time, he was serving as the first U.S. ambassador to Great Britain, but this reminds us that before he achieved fame on both sides of the Atlantic and served as our nation's second president, he was a Quincy farmer first and foremost. Keep in mind that in this context, the word manure refers to something a bit closer to what we'd call compost today. London, July 8th, Saturday. In one of my common walks along the Edgware Road, there are fine meadows, or squares of grassland belonging to a noted cowkeeper. These plots are plentifully manured. There are on the side of the way several heaps of manure, 100 loads perhaps in each heap. I have carefully examined them, and find them to be composed of straw and dung from the stables and streets of London, mud, clay, or marl dug up out of the ditch along the hedge, and turf sward cut up with spades, hoes, and shovels in the road. This is laid in vast heaps to mix. With narrow hoes they cut it down at each end, and with shovels throw it into a new heap, in order to divide it and mix it more effectually. I have attended to the operation as I walked for some time. This may be good manure, but it is not equal to mine, which I composed in similar heaps upon my own farm, of horse dung from Brackett's stable in Boston, marsh mud from the seashore, and street dust from the plain at the foot of Penn's Hill, in which is a mixture of marl.
Finally, Sunday is July 9th. After assuming command of the Continental Army in Cambridge, George Washington had a very busy first week. On July 9th, he met with all his top commanders in a council of war to determine the disposition of the enemy, the strength of the new army, and what the current challenges were. Along with Washington, Generals Ward, Lee, Putnam, Thomas, Heath, Greene, and Gates considered these and other questions. A question was then proposed and considered, viz., what is the supposed number of the enemy near and in Boston, including the troops formerly and lately arrived, and those expected hourly, the forces who may take arms, the sailors who may be spared from the fleet, and the Negroes? Upon which it was agreed that from the best intelligence, the force on the side of the enemy now amounts to 11,500 men. It was then proposed and considered whether it is expedient to keep and defend the post as present occupied or to retire further back into the country. Upon which it was unanimously determined that the public service requires the defense of the present posts. His Excellency then proposed to the consideration of the council what number of troops may be necessary for the present service in and near Boston, to defend the posts already occupied against the force supposed to be employed against us, upon which it was agreed that the army for the above purpose ought to consist of at least 22,000 men.
And now it's time to fast forward from the Revolutionary War to the First World War for our main topic. We're celebrating Independence Day this week, and hearing the Boston Pops perform the Star Spangled Banner is a traditional part of that celebration. But there was a time when our national anthem was used as a cudgel against musicians in Boston. On the evening of October 30th, 1917, the Boston Symphony Orchestra had been invited to play a concert at Infantry Hall in Providence, Rhode Island. Since the U.S. had entered World War I a few months earlier, some orchestras made a habit of opening each performance with the Star-Spangled Banner. The BSO had not yet adopted this practice, and on the day of the concert, they were challenged on three fronts. An article in the Providence Journal doubted the loyalty of the orchestra and Carl Muck, their conductor, saying, "Professor Muck is a man of notoriously pro-German affiliations, and the program as announced is almost entirely German in character." And it challenged them to play the national anthem, to put Professor Muck to the test. The founder and manager of the BSO, Henry Lee Higginson, also received two telegrams that day, one from a patriotic organization and one from a local music club, both of which requested that the orchestra open the evening with a performance of the Star-Spangled Banner. Higginson chose not to pass the messages along to Dr. Muck. Ignoring all the warning signs, the orchestra skipped playing the national anthem and performed an evening of classical pieces by German composers. We might consider that tone deaf, but in the opening months of World War I, it was widely thought to be treason. Despite the fact that he had never seen the requests, newspapers accused Muck of refusing to play the anthem. The BSO's publicity manager would later write that Muck's guilt, so far as America was concerned, was settled that night in Providence because of the short-sighted stubbornness of Henry L. Higginson. Newspaper editorials against Muck became rabid, and within days the former president, Theodore Roosevelt, waded into the controversy, saying, "No man has any business to be engaged in anything that is not subordinate to patriotism. If the Boston Symphony Orchestra will not play the Star-Spangled Banner, it ought to be made to shut up. If Dr. Muck will not play it, he ought not to be at large in this country."
In a country that was overwhelmed with a wave of hatred against hyphenated Americans in general, and German Americans in particular, Karl Muck's personal friendship with Kaiser Wilhelm made him an easy target. Karl Muck was born into a musical family in Germany in 1859, and by the age of 11 he was playing piano in chamber recitals and violin in a symphony. At the age of 21 he got his PhD, acquired Swiss citizenship, and began a career as a conductor and concert pianist in Zurich. Muck became known as a Wagner specialist and worked his way through increasingly prominent positions in symphonies and opera companies. Eventually, he was conducting at the British Royal Opera, the Vienna Philharmonic Orchestra, and the Bayreuth Festival, which was an annual festival of Wagner operas that had been founded by Richard Wagner himself. During his stint at Bayreuth, he became close friends with the Wagner family. This got him noticed at the highest levels, and Kaiser Wilhelm II invited Muck to be the principal conductor of the Berlin Court Opera in 1906. It was one of the most prestigious conducting appointments in Germany, and it put Muck in the Kaiser's inner circle. Not long after that, Henry Lee Higginson went looking for a new conductor for the Boston Symphony Orchestra. Higginson was a man who knew what he liked, and he wasn't one to mince words. He was a traditionalist, and he had this warning for conductors who might be considered for the BSO. "I shall certainly ask them to play the classics as they were played. I was brought up in the Vienna School, and there were plenty of men living then who had heard Beethoven conduct, as well as Mendelssohn, and knew how he wished his music given. I have known Brahms myself and heard his music. You know well enough what I wish, and I shall not interfere unduly with any of these men, but I don't want crazy work, and perhaps you had better tell them that I hate noise."
Higginson was the founder and chief benefactor of the Boston Symphony. He was a Union Army veteran, having been wounded in a cavalry engagement in 1863 that left him with 3 saber slashes and 2 pistol wounds. Having recovered, he entered his father's Boston-based brokerage company, eventually becoming fabulously wealthy by making bets such as, you know, providing startup money for General Motors. With his fortune secure, Higginson founded the BSO in 1881. For decades, he was the orchestra's sole funder, so his taste for German composers would be indulged, as would his desire to emulate the great German orchestras. The first 4 conductors of the BSO had been German or Austrian, and the 5th would be too. In 1906, Henry Higginson settled on Karl Muck as the next musical director of Boston's orchestra. Higginson made a personal appeal to the German Kaiser to get Muck released from his position with the court opera, and Muck made his debut in Boston later that year. A Boston Herald reviewer said, "He stands there calm, undemonstrative, graceful, elegant, aristocratic, a man of singularly commanding and magnetic personality even in repose. The orchestra is his speech, the expression of the composer's music as it appeals to the conductor's brain, heart, and soul." Muck returned to Europe in 1908, but agreed to take over the Boston Symphony Orchestra again in 1912. During the second tenure, he led the BSO in their first national tour in 1915, and in 1917 he took the orchestra to visit the Victor Talking Machine Company in Camden, New Jersey. There, the BSO became the first full orchestra to make a gramophone recording for the company's Victrolas, which were becoming increasingly popular. A modern reviewer says, although the Boston Orchestra was recognized as one of the finest in the USA prior to Muck's appointment, his implacable discipline and outstanding musical taste made it preeminent. Henry Higginson would call Muck the most industrious, painstaking, and ablest conductor whom we have ever had.
All the goodwill and accolades that Muck had accrued seemed to vanish as the controversy around the national anthem heated up. Despite the fact that it was Higginson's stubborn ideals of orchestral purity that kept the BSO from playing the Star-Spangled Banner, it was Carl Muck who would take the brunt of the fallout. By this time, President Wilson was railing against the dangers of hyphenate Americans. There are citizens of the United States, born under other flags, but welcome, under our generous naturalization laws, to the full freedom and opportunity of America, who have poured the poison of disloyalty into the very arteries of our national life. In November 1917, the orchestra announced that they would close every performance with the national anthem, but the damage was done. During the winter of 1917, the BSO was banned from playing in Pittsburgh and Washington, D.C. On March 14, 1918, the BSO was invited to play at Carnegie Hall in New York. As Carl Muck took the stage, he received a standing ovation of almost 2 minutes. Then he led the orchestra in playing the Star-Spangled Banner. It was too late. Less than 2 weeks later, Muck was arrested as an enemy alien, despite the fact that he was a citizen of neutral Switzerland. While he was locked up in Boston's Charles Street Jail, Dr. Muck resigned from the BSO and vowed never to conduct in America again. In the wake of the arrest, Henry Higginson resigned from the Boston Symphony, turning over control to a board of directors. In the meantime, newspapers published salacious excerpts from letters Muck had allegedly written to a 20-year-old Back Bay woman with whom he was said to be having an affair. However, given the earlier lies that newspapers published about him, it's hard to know whether to take these reports seriously.
Soon, Carl Muck was put on a train bound for an internment camp in Georgia, with an armed guard to protect him from the threat of lynch mobs. He was incarcerated at Fort Oglethorpe in the Appalachian foothills north of Atlanta. Dr. Muck was not alone. 29 foreign-born members of the Boston Symphony Orchestra, at the time considered the best in the nation, were incarcerated with him. That was nearly a third of the orchestra's musicians. Despite his vow, Muck was convinced to conduct one last concert on American soil. In the prisoner's mess at his internment camp, he would lead an impromptu orchestra of members of the BSO and other musicians in a performance of Beethoven's Eroica. The Eroica is Beethoven's third symphony, considered the first composition of the Romantic period in Western music. He dedicated the piece to Napoleon Bonaparte, who had not yet declared himself emperor. At the time, Beethoven saw Bonaparte as the embodiment of democracy, come to sweep aside Europe's ailing monarchies and create a new egalitarian society. The symbolism of playing that piece inside a prison camp was not lost on one of Muck's incarcerated audience, who would later write, "The mess hall was packed with 2,000 listeners. The orchestra numbered more than 100 men, picked musicians all. The front benches were reserved for the army officers, the censors, a few doctors in uniform. Behind, wave upon wave, was the sea of nameless, eager faces of the prisoners. In the moment of breathless silence preceding the first note, it was as if an electric current had run through the entire unkempt audience in overalls and shirt sleeves, in heavy camp boots that seemed frozen to the floor. Muck waved his magic wand, and jubilantly the Eroica rushed at us, lifted us on winds, and carried us far away and above war and worry and barbed wire. It is my conviction, and the belief of many others more qualified than I to speak with authority, that this last concert Carl Muck conducted in America was one of his greatest achievements and one of the greatest events in the musical life of the United States."
In August of 1919, Dr. Muck was deported. As he sailed from New York, he gave a bitter interview saying, "I am not a German, although they said I was. I considered myself an American." Back in Germany, he spent the next decade conducting operas and orchestras at the highest levels. But after the Nazi Party took over in Germany, Karl Muck's star began to wane. In 1930, he resigned from the Bayreuth Festival, which was a very public reproach considering Hitler's fascination with Wagner. In 1933, he stepped down from the Hamburg Symphony in protest of Nazi policies. After a decade of declining health and fortunes, Dr. Karl Muck died on March 4, 1940. His New York Times obituary reports, "News of the death of Dr. Muck interrupted a rehearsal by the Boston Symphony Orchestra today. For 2 minutes, the musicians stood in silence, with heads bowed, after they were informed of their former leader's death." It also said that in Boston, he built a virtuoso orchestra. In a strange reprise, composer Igor Stravinsky was accosted by Boston police in 1944 and issued a warning for his arrangement of the Star-Spangled Banner that incorporated an unconventional dominant seventh chord. It was actually the harmless-seeming arrangement that we played at the top of this show that led to this warning. No word on the BPD's opinion of the Jimi Hendrix version.
To learn more about Karl Muck and the BSO during World War I, check out this week's show notes at hubhistory.com/035. We'll have a link to a catalog of the Boston Symphony Orchestra's 1917 and 1918 national tour, including an insert pointing out that the national anthem would be played at the conclusion of their concert in Philadelphia. We'll also have a YouTube video with one of their 1917 gramophone recordings. We'll have a photo of Karl Muck and the orchestra that played behind the wire at Fort Oglethorpe, as well as a series of prints and paintings done by artists interned there. And we'll link to articles where you can read more about the Muck case and make up your own mind. And, of course, we'll have links and sources for all of this week's historical anniversaries. After last week's podcast about pirates on Boston Harbor, I tweeted a rhetorical question asking how a pirate could go from receiving a death sentence to becoming a captain in the Royal Navy. Listener Tim Dempsey got into the spirit of the episode and replied, "He studies naval warfare and kisses up to the admiral." Sorry, someone had to.
Yar.
Well, we approve, Tim. We also had a listener named Daniel Karanja write in to talk about the interesting research he's doing at the Phillips Library in Salem. He gave us a couple of different historical anecdotes about the relationship between the U.S. and the Sultan of Zanzibar. For example, he mentioned an incident in 1851 where the U.S. consul felt that his country's flag was insulted by the Sultan. The consul hauled down the flag in protest and left in a huff. Then he called for a U.S. Navy vessel to be sent to Zanzibar to teach them a lesson. Indeed, the USS Susquehanna was sent in 1852, while on its way to carry Commodore Perry to the historic visit to Japan. Daniel, we'd love to feature one of your stories in a future episode. Just find us one with a strong connection to Boston.
If you want to get in touch with us, you can email us at podcast@hubhistory.com. We're at Hub History on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Or you can go to hubhistory.com and click on the Contact Us link. And while you're on the site, hit the subscribe link and be sure that you never miss an episode. If you subscribe on Apple Podcasts, please write us a brief review. That's the best way to help others discover the show.
That's all for now. But tune in next time, ye scurvy dogs, when we'll be back with part 2 of Boston and the Golden Age of Piracy.